It's time for Dishing Up Nutrition with licensed nutritionist Darlene Kvist. Each week, Darlene explains the connection between what you eat and how you feel. Stay tuned to hear practical, real-life solutions for healthier living through good nutrition. Dishing Up Nutrition is brought to you by Nutritional Weight and Wellness.
Slow down, you move too fast. You got to make the morning last. Just kicking down the cobblestones, looking for fun and feeling groovy.
Well, welcome to Dishing Up Nutrition, and I want to say happy Mother's Day to everyone out there, all those mothers.
A day early, but absolutely.
I know, just so we don't forget. I hope everyone interested in nutrition is listening today, because, and if you happen to have family members or friends confused about what to eat to control cholesterol, diabetes, obesity, cancer, or heart disease, you know, just give them a call. And have them listen to this show, because we have Gary Tobbs, who is the author of Good Calories, Bad Calories, and he's going to discuss the results of 7 years of research into the impact of nutrition that it has had on health. And so he has actually spent, you know, the last 7 years reviewing volumes and volumes of research, and he's come up with some interesting conclusions. You know, he came up with some questions that still need to be researched, but he's also brought in some things that we will have to look at and examine a little bit more. So our co-host, you're happy to say, is Wendy Case Dancer. Wendy is a registered nurse, a nutrition educator, a nutrition counselor. She sees clients in our St. Paul office and our White Bear office, teaches a lot of classes. A little bit busy, aren't you?
Just a little bit. Just a little bit. I was going to say, we've had quite a week, haven't we, Dar?
We have. We have every week. Quite a week.
Yeah, when can we not say that? But this, I'm so excited. This is going to be a great show today, because so many people still believe that butter is bad.
And hard to believe, isn't it?
It is. And margarine is good. That diet drinks are good because they have absolutely no calories. And that eggs are bad for you because they have cholesterol. And red meat is bad because of the saturated fats. And soy is good. So much confusion.
So when I picked up Gary Tobbs' book, Good Calorie, Bad Calories, I literally spent one weekend reading almost every part. Now, I used it as a research book. I just didn't go from front to back. I looked at, you know, I was interested in cholesterol. Then I was interested in metabolism. And then I looked at all those research parts in his book, and I really spent looking at it. And I think for most people interested in the field of nutrition, it's really a must-read for everyone. I mean, it really
absolutely
is.
Everyone should have it on their shelf. It's a great research.
And we don't get it this excited about most.
And
pieces.
That's true. We don't. To help listeners become acquainted with Gary Tobbs, he's a science journalist and is the only print journalist to have won 3 science of Society Journalism Awards given by the National Association of Science. You may have seen Gary on Good Morning America, Nightline, ABC News. Dr. Weil, who many people follow, has recently endorsed his book, Good Calories, Bad Calories.
So let's welcome Gary Tobbs, author of Good Calories, Bad Calories. Gary, we are so pleased to have you on the show.
Well, and, thank you. It's great to be here.
You know, if it's okay, during the second part of the show, we're just going to open up the phone lines and let people ask you as many questions as possible. And, Gary, just to kind of acquaint you, you're talking to people in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area. And
in Minnesota.
In Minnesota. And, you know, we have a show that's called Dishing Up Nutrition, and we have it for an hour every Saturday. And our goal is to really bring up-to-date information to people that makes sense. And so let's start with some hard questions for you, Gary.
Okay.
You know, most people believe that fat, you know, the fat on their body is because they eat too much and they don't exercise enough. So how would you comment about that? Would you agree with it?
Yeah, no, I wouldn't. That's one
Thank
of the...
goodness.
That's probably the most controversial part of my book, and it was what sort of stunned me the most when I actually went back. And what I did is, you know, among other things, I read the medical literature on obesity going back into the 19th century. And this idea that we get fat because we eat too much basically comes from the laws of thermodynamics. And those laws, the first law, energy conservation, basically tells you that if a if you get bigger, you have to take in more energy than you consume. And because of that, people just assume, well, if you take in more energy than you expend, you know, if you overeat, you'll get fat, and therefore that's why we get fat. And this has been the sort of conventional wisdom for 50 years.
Yes, it has.
And the fact is that this laws of thermodynamics don't actually tell you why you take in more energy than you consume, than you expend.
Excuse me.
I keep making that mistake. They tell you that if you get bigger, you have to take in more energy, but not why. There's no causality in that equation. And the example, prior to the Second World War, German and Austrian physicians and physiologists, they thought a lot about obesity. And the example they used is they said, you know, consider a growing child.
Mm-hmm.
A child, you know, when he's growing, he'll eat voraciously. He overeats because he's getting bigger.
Right, exactly.
But he doesn't grow because he overeats. He overeats because he's growing. And he's growing because he's secreting growth hormone.
Okay.
And so the point I make in the book is that when we talk about growth, you know, another example is Barry Bonds, the baseball player. We all know he got a lot bigger over the last 10 years. He's put on about 40 pounds.
Yes, he has.
So he had to overeat. He had to be in what scientists call positive energy balance. He had to take in more calories than he expended, but he didn't get bigger because he overate, because he was in positive energy balance. He got bigger, we assume, because he took steroid hormones.
Yes.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
If he did, allegedly.
Okay.
Yeah.
You can see the difference. The causality is reversed. So when you talk about a growing child, you know that the child overeats because he's growing. And when you talk about an athlete who uses performance-enhancing drugs to put on 30, 40, 50 pounds of muscle, we know that he didn't put on the muscle because he overate. He ate more because he put on, was, you know, these
that hormones. That he was putting on more muscle.
On the muscle.
Okay.
So when you actually look at the same, that kind of causality and why we get fat, so you say, okay, let's just go to first principles. This is what these pre-World War II Europeans said. They said, you know, obesity is a disorder of fat accumulation. You know, we have too much fat on us. Let's
mm-hmm.
see what regulates fat tissue.
Okay, and so what regulates fat tissue? What did they find?
That's the unfortunate, you know, the joke is we've known that for 40 years, and unfortunately it's the hormone insulin.
It always goes back to insulin, doesn't it?
And we secrete insulin in response to the carbohydrates we eat in our diet. So if you actually look at the underlying sort of physiology of fat tissue, which again is not controversial, you'll find out that carbohydrates should make us fat. Not all calories, just the carbohydrates, just the foods that our mothers grew up believing did make them fat. You know, bread and pasta and potatoes and pastries and sweets of all kinds and beer.
And how did we get away from that belief system if our grandmothers and mothers thought this?
Well, the two things. First of all, physicians just couldn't get it out of their head that if somebody was obese, they were engaged in the sins of gluttony and or sloth, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Jerome Gropman says this in his book about how doctors think. He points out doctors, you know, they're sort of grossed out by obese patients.
I mean, Gary, we've heard that. I mean, we hear that from clients that, you know, that have really extra weight and how embarrassed they are sometimes when they don't
step on the scale. Yeah, absolutely.
And honestly, they don't want to even go see their medical doctor because they don't want to be ridiculed in some, you know, and it's not out there, but they can see the looks that they're getting.
Yeah, no, and it's sort of these people, we just think, well, somehow they just sat around on their butts all day long.
And they're just weak-willed people.
And they're weak-willed problem. And the problem is they will tend to be inactive because they're losing all this energy into their fat tissue. So, you know, here's the way you imagine Lance Armstrong, for example. Lance Armstrong eats a lunch of, say, 1,000 calories of pasta.
Yeah.
And his body wants to burn up those carbohydrates. That's what his body wants to do with them. So he eats at lunch, and then he goes for a three-hour bike ride.
Right.
And again, reversing the causality. This is all about determining what's the real cause and what's the real effect. But for someone like Lance Armstrong, you'd say he's not lean because he works out so much. He works out so much because his body doesn't want to store calories as fat. it wants to burn it.
So, Gary, do you think that that goes back to being more of a genetic predisposition?
I think the genetics predetermine how you respond to the carbohydrates in the diet. You know, so the genetics, again, there's this concept that is in modern research called fuel partitioning, but nobody pays attention to it when they talk about human obesity. But this fuel partitioning idea looks at all the different pathways in the body that determine how you use the fuel that you consume. So you can burn it for fuel, for energy, or you can store it. And there are different sort of molecular pathways in your cells and in your fat tissue and hormonal responses that determine, you know, what you're going to do with the fuel. So if you're predisposed to burn it, if you have a big meal, you're going to want to go exercise. It's like your body saying, look, we have all this energy available. Use it.
Well, and, but, you know, Gary, as you look at the population these days, and we know that I think, 67% of the population is overweight now. So are we having more and more people that are genetically predisposed to gaining weight more easily?
Well, no, this is the second part of the answer to your question, what happened to this science. When we started to believe that dietary fat caused heart disease, beginning in the late 1950s, and this really started to gel with the American Heart Association in the 1960s, if you want people to avoid a high-fat diet because you think it's giving them heart disease, you have to tell them to eat a high-carbohydrate diet. Diet is a trade-off in that sense. The protein content of the diet stays relatively constant, and so if you tell someone, look, you got to eat low-fat, then you're telling them to eat high-carb. So these same foods that were kind of universally considered fattening prior to the 1960s, by the end of the 1970s, were being pushed as heart-healthy diet foods.
Right.
And
yep.
We started eating more carbohydrates. So all these foods, you know, suddenly it's like Jane Brody in her Good Food book, which was a bestseller in 1985. That book was subtitled. Jane Brody's has been a health columnist for the New York Times for 30 years now, and suddenly she's telling her 1985 Good Food book is subtitled Living the High Carbohydrate Way.
That's right.
And so the idea is we're supposed to eat pasta and we're supposed to eat bagels and we're supposed to eat potatoes, because not only will these foods prevent heart disease, they'll keep us lean.
And what happened?
Well, and then what happens is we have an obesity and a diabetes epidemic.
That's right. Yeah.
The other thing that happened...
You know, Gary, can I put you on hold for just a minute? We have to take a break.
Sure.
Producer is saying that. But, you know, I love your thoughts and your comments. So you're listening to Dishing Up Nutrition, brought to you by Nutritional Weight and Wellness, a company specializing in therapeutic nutrition. Often people have not heard about therapeutic nutrition. People mistake nutrition for calorie restriction for weight loss. This is not therapeutic nutrition. For example, last week, several of my new clients came in to see me because of irritable bowel syndrome, IBS, which means a lot of diarrhea and a lot of constipation. That's negatively affecting their lives. IBS is a nutrition problem that can be corrected with nutrition. So today, if you have questions for Gary, just give us a call at 651-641-1071.
Looking for a speaker for your next meeting, conference, or education hour? How about a topic that affects your audience both professionally and personally? Health and nutrition resonate on many levels because all of us want to look and feel our best. Nutrition educators from Nutritional Weight and Wellness address groups of all sizes on topics varying from Nutrition 101 to increasing metabolism, balancing moods, hormonal health, and restful sleep. Presentations range from 1 hour to full-day seminars and can be tailored to your group's interests. What can you expect? Sound information with real-life examples, making the topic accessible and relevant to your group. Motivating, interactive presentation styles that engage the audience. Handouts and takeaway strategies for practical application and ongoing impact. Nutritional Weight and Wellness delivers information that makes a difference in people's lives by changing the way people think about food. Enthusiastic audience responses often result in return appearances to explore other topics. Call 651-699-3438 to learn more about booking a nutrition educator for your next meeting or event. 651-699-3438.
Hey, Mr. tambourine man play a song for me. I'm not sleepy, and there is no place I'm going to.
Welcome back to Dishing Up Nutrition. I'm Wendy Kate Stancer, a registered nurse. I'm here with Darlene Kvist, and we have a special guest, Gary Tobbs, here today. He has written the book, Good Calories, Bad Calories. And before we get back to our discussion, we just want people to know that it's not the rest of your life. You do not have to suffer from irritable bowel syndrome, do you, Dar?
No. It's a nutritional
problem. With correct nutrition, you do not need to struggle with irritable bowel syndrome and many, many, many other health conditions. And before we went on break, we were talking with Gary about heart disease and eating low fat to prevent heart disease and how that has affected us
and,
as a culture.
And, you know, Gary, you're probably on the line with us now. We were kind of talking about how people got into, you know, gaining weight. 67% of the population actually have a weight problem now, and it's more of an insulin problem, isn't it? It goes back to, for that body, eating too many carbohydrates.
Right. Well, that's, you know, insulin certainly controls fat accumulation. And, again, this has been known since the early 1960s, and the fundamental thing that you have to accomplish to lose weight is to lower insulin levels. And so, again, what happened is, you know, we started eating high-carb diets, basically, and not only that, we started, the other thing I was going to say is in the late 1970s, high fructose corn syrup started replacing sugar in soft drinks. And metabolically, they're probably identical, high fructose corn syrup and sugar. But what happened is, I don't think as a culture we realized that high fructose corn syrup was sugar. So suddenly all these health drinks come in, like Snapple and soba iced teas and all these fruit juices, and they're basically glorified sugar water.
Mm-hmm.
But because the nutrition, you know, the nutrition labels say that the first ingredient is this thing that sounds healthy, high fructose corn syrup, and we talk about fructose as fruit sugar.
Right.
It just seemed that we didn't really associate that with the sugar that we had all thought was sort of vaguely a dietary evil. And what you see from the 1980s to today is a dramatic increase in the consumption of what they call caloric sweeteners, which are sugar and high fructose corn syrup together. So it went up by almost an average by almost 30 pounds per capita in the United States per year.
30 pounds, you said, 30 pounds.
Yeah, from around 120 pounds per person per year, which is already an enormous amount. That's
right.
The average, you realize. So some people are eating a lot more than that, to 150 pounds per person per year. And that was
wow.
The first time, really, since about the 1920s that we'd seen such a significant jump in sweetener consumption. And so that assuredly contributes as well, but not because of the empty calories, but because of the effect of these, the carbohydrates. That both high fructose corn syrup and sugar are effectively half glucose and half fructose. These are two different kinds of sugar. And glucose raises your insulin levels, and fructose gets kind of dumped on your liver, and your liver responds by converting it into fat and then shipping it out to your fat storage. And it also probably leads over the long term to this condition called insulin resistance.
So I think, Gary, if you would repeat that one more time, because I think people, if you can help people picture what's really going on when they're drinking their, you know, their Coke or their fruit juice, or they're putting it in their kids' bottles. I mean, you see this all the time. They're putting
in the baby bottles,
right? The baby bottles, and they're putting that in, you know, they're putting some kind of juice with corn syrup sweetener in it.
Well, it's funny. That's the kind of thing that happened once we got on this notion that dietary fat is bad for us. So suddenly even mothers are so worried about their kids' cholesterol levels that instead of giving them whole milk, they're
right.
giving them fruit juice.
Yes.
And, you know, it's less than a year of age. When I see this, you know, walking around the streets of New York, I'm horrified.
I mean, we are too.
Here.
Yeah.
The
yes,
kids love it because it's sweet.
Well, yes.
You know, so it's like, in my mind, and again, this stuff, a lot of what I'm saying a lot of what I'm saying is based on, you know, hard research. A lot is sort of speculation because the research was never done, because we're so obsessed with dietary fat and cholesterol and this idea that it's all about how many calories you consume or how much exercise you do that causes weight, that we never looked into the true effect of these nutrients on sort of the metabolic state of the body and the hormonal response. But yeah, the idea is sugar, what we call sugar, which is technically called sucrose, is a molecule of glucose bonded to a molecule of fructose. And the high fructose corn syrup we drink, it's known as HFCS55, and that's 55% fructose and 45% glucose. So sugar is 50-50, and high fructose corn syrup is 55-45. So they're effectively the same thing. And once you consume them, the glucose is sort of dumped into your bloodstream, and your pancreas responds by secreting insulin. And this insulin tells your muscle cells to burn the glucose, and it tells your fat cells to burn the glucose, but it also basically tells your fat to store any other nutrients that might be available. So it tells your fat to accumulate fat. And the fructose is only metabolized in the liver. So that's actually shunted to the liver through what's called the portal vein, and it's dumped on the liver, and your liver responds by converting it into fat.
Yes, and that's...
It doesn't know what to do with it. We didn't evolve to sort of deal with this kind of dumping of fructose into our bodies.
I know it, and I think that's the thing. And I think if people can possibly understand that, that when they go and grab an iced tea that's got sugar in it, but it's usually has corn syrup sweetener in it, that you're in real trouble.
Yeah, and again, the point is it doesn't really matter whether it's corn from the fructose is from sugar or corn syrup. It's funny, the way the corn refiners industry deals with the tax on high fructose corn syrup is they say it's no worse than sugar. And the fact is it's probably not no worse than sugar. But another way of phrasing that is sugar is no better than high fructose corn syrup.
Okay.
They're both
right.
Probably primary reasons why people get fat, and they're probably the primary drivers of what's called metabolic syndrome, which is, you know, when we get heart disease, it's not going to be because we have high total cholesterol or we have high LDL cholesterol. For some huge proportion of us, it will be because we have we pass through this condition called metabolic syndrome, and that's probably primarily caused by the kinds of carbohydrates we eat, and sugar probably plays a fundamental role in that.
So, Gary, let's hold on that. We're going to need to take another break. You're listening to Dishing Up Nutrition, brought to you by Nutritional Weight and Wellness, a company dedicated to bringing you nutritional information that can improve your health. If you're insulin resistant and eat a carbohydrate-rich meal such as a plate of pasta, a bowl of cereal, you know, insulin is secreted and it induces hunger and it traps fat into the fat cells. For most people, processed carbs increase our hunger and helps our cells store fat. So if you have questions for Gary today about metabolism or cholesterol, our number is 651-641-1071.
Welcome back to Dishing Up Nutrition. I'm Wendy Kate Stancer, registered nurse, nutrition educator. I am here with Darlene Kvist, licensed nutritionist. And joining us from New York today is Gary Tobbs, author of Good Calories, Bad Calories. And we welcome your questions today for Gary. If you have any about good calories, bad calories, call us at 651-641-1071. And we know that Gary has spent the last 7 years reading and analyzing nutrition research conducted over the past 50 years. And Gary, I would like to ask you, how did you get into this and how did you come to want to write the book, Good Calories, Bad Calories?
Well, my specialty as a journalist since I started in the early 1980s was in controversial science. I actually started writing about high-energy physics and lived at a physics lab and watched some very smart physicists discover non-existent elementary particles. And I just got obsessed with how hard it is to do science right, to discover reliable knowledge. And in the early 90s, I moved into public health research because the science there was so shoddy that there, I just kept kind of moving from one subject to the next, getting deeper and deeper into some of our fundamental beliefs about what constitutes a healthy diet and a healthy lifestyle. And the result, eventually just took me to this book. It was a kind of odd progression that was based on the notion of just sort of following the evidence and seeing where it would lead me.
Well, I think one of your first, at least one of your first articles that I read was, what if it's been a big fat lie, and we've been actually using it in our classes, and it kind of given credibility to what we believe and teaching people good fats and healthy fats, and they're good for you, and to reduce the carbohydrates. So we loved your article, Gary.
Well, thank you.
And so we've been following you ever since that. So
well, that was actually I was working for the journal Science. I had a great relationship with my editor, so they'd give me a lot of time. I'd sometimes spend a year on a story.
Oh, wow.
And that was actually the third story I had written on this this series, more or less, starting with the idea that salt is responsible for raising our blood pressure, and then moving in just to the notion that a low-fat diet is a healthy diet at all. And then I wanted to see, I had this idea that maybe you could see what really did start the obesity epidemic, and that's what led to that New York Times Magazine cover, What If It's All Been a Big Fat Lie.
So, Gary, going back to the salt raising your blood pressure, I think most people believe that.
Yeah, most people do, and I'm actually going to a conference in Albany in a couple of weeks where they want to discuss how to, regulate the salt content of processed foods, and I'm there to make the point that the evidence that salt causes blood pressure really is pretty terrible. If you just think about it, we're trying to avoid hypertension, because hypertension is a risk factor for heart disease. But if you're obese, you're probably hypertensive. If you're diabetic, you're probably hypertensive. If you're gout, you're likely to have hypertension. All these disorders are known as hypertensive states, and yet they're all considered to be caused by different nutrition. We get heart disease because of saturated fat. We get obesity because we're sedentary.
What some people believe. That's what you're saying, right?
Yeah, exactly. and the point I make in the book is that if they're all hypertensive states, maybe they're all caused by the same thing as this hypertension. And lo and behold, as it turns out, and this has been known for at least 40-odd years, insulin does a very good job of regulating blood pressure. It actually makes your kidneys retain sodium, salt. So raising your insulin levels is the equivalent of eating more salt.
Mm-hmm. And that's really hard for people to get their head around.
Yeah, again, and it's sort of the way one of the researchers who studies carbohydrate-restricted diets, the way he phrases it, he says, you're not what you eat, you're what your body does with what you eat.
Yes,
exactly.
And so, for instance, then you eat a lot of carbohydrates, you eat a lot of sugar. Your body, one of the things your kidneys do is retain sodium, which makes your body retain water, which makes your blood pressure go up. The fructose that we were talking about, that has the effect of raising uric acid, which also affects your kidney, which also makes your blood pressure go up. So the simplest possible hypothesis is that refined carbohydrates and sugar raise blood pressure.
And not the salt,
because it makes you retain all the fluid, yes. Even when you say it increases uric acid, which is
gout.
Also gout. Yes.
Yeah, that's gout. And it's funny, when you look at the history of gout, I did this, it never made it into the book because the book was too long. But you look at the history of gout, and it sort of spread through the world in the same way that sugar did, and at the same time. So first, gout is a disease of royalty.
Yep.
Then it's a disease of the wealthy. Then it's a disease of everyone. And at the time when sugar starts off as a luxury for royalty, then as a luxury for the wealthy, and then it becomes not a luxury for everyone, but something that people will spend their money on rather than other things. So it sort of you know, epidemiologically, sugar is the obvious explanation for gout, and yet in theory we get gout because of the alcohol and meat consumption.
Right.
Well, the alcohol with all the sugar could be, but why not? You know, it's so interesting when people call and they want to make an appointment for if they've got gout, and I say, well, probably the first thing you have to do is reduce your sugar intake, and they go, oh, I've never heard that before. It's always like, I need to reduce my fat and my protein, and you know, but it always works, Gary. So,
well, that, and, it does, and what's interesting is because there's been an effective pharmaceutical cure or treatment for gout since the 1960s, people stopped studying it just about the same time that they started realizing that fructose elevates uric acid. So it's one of these things again, and I would have written about this if I could have written, you know, an infinite book.
Yeah, maybe we need a second book.
I interviewed all the people involved, and they said, yeah, we had this drug, what's called allopurinol, and once we had that drug, there was no real reason to continue studying gout.
Yeah, I bet that happens in more than just gout.
I'm sure it does. So again, it's one of these diseases, and gout is actually the frequency of gout has been going up in coincidence with the obesity, diabetes, and diabetes epidemics, but nobody really cares because it can be treated.
Well, sort of treated, but...
Sort of treated.
The symptoms.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But it can be, in effect, cured by, I would assume, as you're saying, restricting sugar consumption.
It can, yes. But that's not what most people think. So, Gary, we have to take another quick break.
Okay.
Okay. You're listening to Dishing Up Nutrition, brought to you by Nutritional Weight and Wellness, an organization specializing in life-changing nutrition information. If you missed our three-hour menopause seminar last Wednesday night, we have another one scheduled for June 18th. And Sandy Greenquist and Wendy will be offering that class on June 18th, and then they're going to be offering it again in Wayzata in July. And I know you guys had a great time.
We had a wonderful time. Yep, we did.
Where they talked about perimenopause and menopause. And if you want to register for that June 18th class, call Hannah today at 651-699-3438, and we'll be back in a minute.
Welcome back to Dishing Up Nutrition. I want to reintroduce our guest, Gary Tobbs, the author of Good Calories, Bad Calories. He's appeared on Good Morning America, Nightline, ABC News, and NPR. And before we get back to our conversation, I just want everybody, all our listeners, to know that we've had lots and lots of callers. We're going to try to get to some before the end of the show, but we also feel it's very, very important, Gary, for you to talk to us about triglycerides and cholesterol. We know you have a whole chapter about that, and people are so confused and worried about their cholesterol. Can you address that for us?
Well, the idea that total cholesterol is a meaningful risk factor for heart disease dates to the 1960s and was pretty much debunked by NIH studies by the 1970s. By that time, then that's when we got on this idea that it was all about the LDL, the low-density lipoproteins, aka the bad cholesterol.
Right.
And the primary evidence that LDL is meaningful, it's a risk factor for heart disease, that statin drugs lower LDL, and statin drugs prevent heart disease in high-risk patients and maybe slightly lower-risk patients. That's open to question. And so that's basically been the reason ever since the 1980s that we've been told to eat less saturated fats. We could lower LDL cholesterol, and the reason we should lower LDL cholesterol is because statin drugs work. And when you actually look at what happened to the data, the science since the 1970s, it evolved. So it went from being, you know, total cholesterol was bad to LDL cholesterol was bad. And in the early 1980s, a fellow at Berkeley named Ron Krauss started looking at LDL closely, and he realized that LDL is composed of a whole spectrum of different types of, you know, LDL particles that go from very large and fluffy to very small and dense.
Mm-hmm.
And now we know that it's the small and dense LDL particles that are what they call the atherogenic ones. They're the ones that, you know, cause or exacerbate atherosclerosis, heart disease. And again, when you have small, dense LDL, you probably have high triglycerides, you probably have low HDL, you probably have this condition called insulin resistance. And this is all wrapped up in this larger condition called metabolic syndrome, which is, you know, if you're you have hypertension and you have you're overweight or obese, they're all, you know, it's all sort of one big cluster of metabolic abnormalities that all are caused, including the small dense LDL, by the kind of carbohydrates we eat, not by the fat in the diet. That's sort of the joke, is that saturated fat has no effect on this metabolic syndrome. It's all about these easily digestible refined carbohydrates and sugar. You know, the same foods that literally make us fat are the foods that cause metabolic syndrome. And we've just been locked into this LDL notion because physicians can measure it, because when they want to put you on statins, they're looking at your LDL numbers. And so the whole concept of a healthy diet has been driven by this sort of drug effect.
What, just like with gout, you know, we have a medication to treat gout. Now we have a medication to treat cholesterol.
Right.
Would you agree?
So that's what we do, and because we're treating LDL cholesterol, that's how they see it. We're lowering LDL cholesterol. We have to tell our patients to eat less saturated fat and more, you know, carbohydrates, because that's another way of lowering LDL cholesterol. And the problem is, first of all, it's quite possible that the reason statins work is because they work, for instance, preferentially on these small, dense LDL particles and not just lowering the whole LDL number. And that's the kind of thing, if this was a real science instead of this sort of pseudoscience of medicine, that, you know, the research would be dedicated to trying to figure out.
That.
And, you know, and I think the other thing that happens, Gary, is a lot of people start taking those medications and then they stop looking at their nutrition, which is really at the bottom of everything. And they say, well, I'm on a medication. I can go ahead and eat all these carbohydrates, or, you know, I can keep drinking my pop or whatever it is.
I think that's very true. And I think, you know, one of the things I argue when I lecture about this is, you know, obesity is associated with a higher risk of diabetes, of heart disease, of cancer, of Alzheimer's. And now diabetes is associated with a higher risk of Alzheimer's.
Right, exactly.
So on some level, whatever makes you fat makes you sick, gives us these chronic diseases. They're known as diseases of civilization that we're all probably going to succumb with. And there's just no way to get around that.
And so, I think, Gary, the other thing is that people, you know, if they start looking at their own personal biochemistry, and that's what I always try to tell people, is kind of look at your own personal biochemistry, because the reality is many of us, including myself, and Wendy, you would fit that category too.
Yes, I would.
We cannot eat very many carbohydrates. We eat vegetables and very little fruit, and we basically do not eat grains, maybe a little bit of wild rice or something, and that's the only way that we can keep our metabolic syndrome in check and our insulin in check.
And that's the point. On some level, you could tell from your weight what the effect of these foods are doing. If you're getting heavier, then it means your insulin levels have gone up.
Exactly.
And if your insulin levels have gone up, they play havoc all over your body. I just read a report last week from the Salk Institute in La Jolla, California, where they were saying, you know, and the Salk, it's a prestigious place, and they're saying, okay, the reason diabetics have an increased risk of Alzheimer's is because of the effect of insulin on their brains. And so if that's true, you know, you think, well, with diabetics, it's because they're taking insulin, but their insulin levels are elevated all the time, and carbohydrates raise your insulin levels. So what you want to do, and these researchers, for reasons I really don't understand, despite all my research, they don't like to say, look, if insulin can explain why diabetics have an increased risk of Alzheimer's, it could explain why the obese have an increased risk of Alzheimer's, and it seems that the healthiest diet is the one that prompts the lowest insulin response. So, you know, green leafy vegetables are fine because they're mostly water and fiber, indigestible carbohydrates, the fiber. There's very actually low digestible carbohydrate, you know, content in green leafy vegetables.
Exactly.
But when you get into starchy vegetables like potatoes and corn, and then refined carbohydrates of any type and sugar, now you would think, look, they're going to raise your insulin levels, and if they raise your insulin levels, they're going to, you know, play havoc throughout your body.
Yep. So, Gary, we have to take another quick break. You are listening to Dishing Up Nutrition. Joining us today is Gary Tobbs, author of Good Calories, Bad Calories, a book I would recommend to those interested in understanding why so many people are confused about nutrition. You will enjoy the discussion about how nutritional ideas and concepts became nutritional practices by the masses. These practices often have no research to support their use. So no wonder people are so confused today. And when we come back, we're going to take a call, and we'll be right back.
Welcome back to Dishing Up Nutrition. Gary, I know your book, Good Calories, Bad Calories, is at all the major bookstores and on Amazon. In the future, where can people get to see you? Will you be coming to Minnesota at all for a book signing or anything?
Well, I hope to. I've recently been speaking with a professor of nutrition at the University of Minnesota, and she heard me lecture at Andrew Weil's Nutrition and Health Conference in April down in Phoenix, and wants to get me into the University of Minnesota to lecture.
I think that just sounds absolutely great.
Let's do it.
Well, I still haven't heard back from her. So say this was about a week ago, 2 weeks ago we talked, and she was going to see what she could do. And
oh, that would be great, because
I want to speak there because there's a high sort of density of influential obesity and nutrition researchers at the University of Minnesota, and the Mayo Clinic as well, of course.
Exactly.
And I think, I'm having trouble getting the, quote, experts, unquote, to pay attention to my book and my message, because they naturally think, well, what can we possibly learn from a journalist? And I don't blame them.
I think we've learned a lot today.
I think so, too.
Right, but that's the thing. You have to care enough. And it's a big book, as I've said several times, and they're busy people. So my way of dealing with it is to, you know, get in and lecture at their institutions, and then they only have to commit an hour of their time, and usually they'll do it. So
great.
Well, it sounds, you know, Gary, we really appreciate you being on, and you have a great day for the rest of the day, and all the mothers have a happy Mother's Day tomorrow, and thank you for listening.
Life, I love you, always groovy. Ba-da-ba-ba-da-ba-ba-ba.